Gangsters have long been amongst the Kremlin's tools of choice, both at home but also abroad. But is that becoming more the case now? I suspect, alas, that it is. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. So I'm again issuing this podcast earlier than the usual schedule because very shortly I have to head off to go and catch a plane to Copenhagen and thence to Berlin. So it was now or never. But I also just wanted to add, because of that reason, those of you who are already patrons will have been notified about a sort of further clarification, in some ways expansion, of the benefits available at different levels of the Patreon. Those of you who aren't, but who might be interested, it'll be going up on the Patreon website probably next weekend. It's just, as I said, a question, alas, of time. Anyway, on to this talk. And before I actually launch into it, I have an apology to make. If you happen to be one of the, I must say, actually impressive and engaged students on the CTOC, the Countering Transnational Organized Crime course, held at the Marshall Center in Garmisch-Partenkirchen, my apologies, because much of what I'm about to say you will have heard in the lecture I gave you. Not exactly the same, not least because I don't actually talk off a script, but nonetheless, you know, you may decide that actually this is one episode to skip, but I hope you don't. But for everyone else, let's start in Spain and the case of Maxim Kuzminov, who back in August of last year, he was a Russian pilot flying a Mil-8 helicopter, and he defected to the Ukrainian side. And alas for them, particularly, his two other crew members who didn't want to defect ended up getting killed in the process. And he was much fated, he was given a new identity, he was given $500,000, and off he went. And then he turned up again. He turns up in February of this year, dead, in a parking garage with a half dozen bullets in him, in Villa Yoyosa in Spain, which is very close to the Costa Blanca. Now, it really shouldn't surprise that the Russian state would have continued to go after him. After all, it's not just that we know that Putin himself has a particular bee in his bonnet about traitors, regarding them as a totally different species from enemies, enemies you fight with, but you could perhaps in some day reach some kind of a deal with, traitors you can do nothing with but kill. But it's also the fact that in a time of war, you want to very performatively and demonstratively prove that there is no gain from turning against the motherland like this, if nothing else, precisely to deter potential other defectors. So it's hardly a surprise, and certainly the way that, for example, Sergei Naryshkin, the head of the Foreign Intelligence Service, put it, he was a moral corpse the moment he began planning his dirty and terrible crime. You know, it's clear that there is no love lost in Moscow. Now, some people are suggesting that it was the SVR, the Foreign Intelligence Service, that was behind this hit. I wonder if, in fact, it's more likely to be GRU, military intelligence, not least because shortly after Kuzminov's defection, they said that an order on his fate has already been promulgated and, quote, its fulfilment is only a matter of time. But who actually would have pulled the trigger? Now, clearly, I have no idea, nor indeed yet to the Spanish authorities, it seems. But nonetheless, to me, this feels more like a contract killing carried out by organised crime than necessarily that of a state assassin. Now, look, we know, just ask the good people of Salisbury, that Russian state assassins can be subcompetent, to put it mildly. But nonetheless, just simply the way this happened, I don't know. I don't know if it would have made sense, frankly, for actual officers to be dispatched from Moscow, particularly in the current time where it's not that easy to do so, it's not that easy to get false documentation that'll hold up, etc. So I do wonder if this is organised crime, especially because the location is very close to the Costa Blanca, where we do know that there's a quite substantial Russian organised crime presence still. I mean, back in, I think it was October, there was a fairly major operation against them. For example, some 40 people were arrested. They're particularly involved in money laundering and such like. So, you know, there is a strong Russian organised or Russian-based organised crime presence in Spain generally, despite some very effective efforts by the Spanish law enforcement agencies, and in particular close to where the hit took place. This, for me, looked very much like the kind of operation that one would expect to be subcontracted, because we have seen similar, and I'll be talking about them later on, but we have, for example, the murder of Zelimkan Kangwashvili in Berlin, the killings of a bunch of Chechens in Turkey, and on the list goes. And so that seems to be a suitable hook on which to talk more broadly about this particular threat and the degree to which Russian and Russian-based organised crime is something that we ought to roll into our overall expectations and assumptions about the covert threat that Moscow composed to the West. And in some ways, my view is precisely that it's a particularly important one now. We've had, 600 diplomats, of whom 400 were meant to, or presumed to have been spies, expelled across Europe. Now, obviously, that's a good thing in the main, though there is a reason why counterintelligence services often prefer to keep known agents in place, because at least then they know who they should be watching. But nonetheless, there's no way of getting around the fact that this represented a massive blow to Russia's agent networks abroad. But on the other hand, Moscow clearly does not want to stop the kind of covert operations which these people could run. Well, if you can't rely so much on your classic intelligence assets, operating under official cover as, you know, the cliched second cultural attaché or whatever else, you have to look elsewhere. And a parsimonious and indeed morally flexible, shall we say, Kremlin can find, amongst others, those kind of proxy assets within Russian-based organised crime. Now, why do I say Russian-based organised crime rather than Russian? Because I think we have to appreciate that they need not be ethnically Russian. In fact, many of them are not. We quite often see, for example, the big criminal combines which kind of originated and largely based in Russia and which then spread out across Europe and beyond. They include lots of Georgians and Armenians and Tajiks and whatnot. Indeed, Georgians in particular, ever since Georgia actually launched its very effective campaign against them in 2005, illegalising not just specific crimes, but actually being a Vorova Zakonye, one of the sort of senior figures within the underworld, which led many of them to flee, a lot of them to Russia. And the point is that ethnicity matters less because, quite frankly, the important point is this. Is the centre of gravity of your criminal organisation in Russia? Because if it is, it is subject both to being threatened and squeezed by the authorities, but also more likely to be able to be offered opportunities that I'll come to in the future. Now, as we see the greater sort of pressure and constriction and containment of Russia, what's happening is a lot of these filiali, a lot of these local branches, including, for example, in Spain, are becoming increasingly autonomous. And quite frankly, if this goes on, I wouldn't be surprised if they basically broke with the central gang structures back in Russia. In some ways, you know, what we'd end up with is a situation as with the Italian mafia, in which the Sicilians and the other Italian gangs do continue to have relationships with the Cosa Nostra in the United States, not least based on common language, culture, understandings, as well as people. But on the other hand, neither one is actually in charge of the other. They just simply do deals. So I think we might be heading that way, but we're not there yet. So at present, the Russian headquarters, let's say, of these criminal networks still have considerable authority over the filiali, the regional branches, which means that basically the Kremlin can contact and make deals with them and expect them, therefore, to charge people who are in Spain or wherever else to do what the Kremlin demands. So this is why it's Russian-based, because if we say Russian organised crime, we have an assumption that they're all going to be ethnically Russian, and that's a mistake. So it doesn't matter if they're, I mean, if they could be people like Tariel Lonyani, the infamous Georgian godfather, who, you know, most of his senior figures are Georgians. But nonetheless, he's in Moscow. He has been arrested by the state. When the state wants to put pressure upon him, it can. It's all about the leverage. And this is particularly important precisely because of just how quickly and how effectively Russian-based... Okay, sometimes I'm going to say Russian organised crime, because otherwise it just sounds so clumsy. But anyway, these gangsters. These gangsters actually internationalised incredibly quickly and effectively in the 1990s with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And in part, that was because of pull factors, that actually it was relatively easy to move into the West. There were huge economic opportunities. It was also push factors. No one was quite sure what was going to happen in Russia. Was the economy going to collapse completely? Were the communists going to come back? Was some kind of fascist regime going to emerge? In those contexts, it made sense to internationalize, because then you reduced your vulnerability. You ensured that you had people and assets abroad just in case you one day had to jump ship. So in this situation, at a time when anyway, you know, we had the beginnings of the true sort of globalization and the interconnectivity of markets, economies, financial systems and the like, the Russians were in the perfect position to move out. Now, of course, what happened was at first they managed to mishandle the process dramatically. At first, they crashed out above all into Central and Northern Europe, thinking that they were going to basically take over. After all, they had the men, they had the money, they had the guns, they had the least to lose. So they were, in the early 1990s, this force that some people were writing about as if it was going to become the headquarters of some sort of new mafia empire. Now, that didn't happen. First of all, mafias don't migrate that way. And there's an excellent book by Federico Varese of Oxford that demonstrates that, in fact, usually when mafias try to migrate, it's actually because of failure and vulnerability at home. But secondly, that actually they're unlikely to have any great success unless they're in a position to capitalise on a particular local economic need or other open ecological niche, shall we say, in the underworld. And what happened was, yes, at first the Russians and the other sort of Russian-based gangs, particularly like, say, the Chechens in the Baltic states, for example, made a splash, and they made money, and they left bodies in their wake. And yet they were quickly fought back. Why? Well, A, because precisely they just wasn't an open space for them. But secondly, often they had to cope with an informal, I should stress, alliance between local gangsters and local law enforcement. From the point of view of the state, they were disproportionately dangerous. They were a security threat, not just a crime threat, because precisely, you know, who knows what links they had back in Moscow and so forth. And likewise, for local organised crime, they were a real serious threat because they were trying to muscle in on their turfs and their markets. So what would happen is precisely that the state would focus on these invaders, and often they would be implicitly helped by the local gangsters. I remember once talking to an Estonian law enforcer, who said that, you know, those are the days. Scarcely a week would go by without him getting some kind of anonymous tip-off about what the Russians, and indeed particularly the Chechens, were doing. And he knew full well that it was coming from local gangsters who, from their point of view, were using the state to do their dirty work. But from his point of view, he was fine with that. You know, there's time enough to deal with Estonian gangs once you've pushed the Russians out, or at least brought them back down to size. So the early ambitions of being the kind of criminal conquistadors who were taking over new turf, that didn't work. Instead, what happened, though, is that they came back essentially in the 2000s in a very different guise, essentially as entrepreneurs, as merchant adventurers. And they were able to do this because of the particular characteristics of Russian organised crime back in Russia. Remember, this, you know, it had its roots in the sort of tattooed hard men of the gulags, the members of the Vorovskoy Mir, the criminal world. But that old world, however great it is for TV and cinema, frankly had very quickly declined in the 1980s and then into the 1990s. You still see people with tattoos and so forth, and people who call themselves Vory Vazokonye, but no one really follows the old, very harsh codes. And generally speaking, we now have a much more flexible, much more recognisable type of organised crime culture, particularly dominated by the so-called autoriteti, the authorities. And the autoriteti were primarily what we could think of as criminal businessmen. Remember, they emerged really at the same time as capitalism, of a sort, emerged in Russia. And as a result, given that capitalism was seen quite primitively as just simply buying and selling and making money, rather than appreciating that there's actually a whole substructure of trusts and understandings that underpin a proper working capitalist economy. But from their point of view, it was just about making money as quickly, as efficiently, and as safely as possible. And so most of these autoriteti proved to be very entrepreneurial and possessing of a wide portfolio of businesses, which range from the entirely criminal, dealing in heroin or trafficking humans or whatever else, all the way to the entirely legitimate, with a lot of grey in between. I mean, for example, the classic things would be, a shop, totally above board shop, except that a lot of the produce, the goods it sells are counterfeit or untaxed. Or a factory that is doing entirely legitimate activity, but is also being used as a way of buying the precursor chemicals that you will need to produce methamphetamines. So, this is the kind of criminal environment. We have a tendency to think of criminals often as being just criminals. In fact, especially the Russians, I mean, this doesn't just apply to the Russians, but particularly the Russians, were very multitasking in their activities. And they didn't really care if they were doing crime or not crime. It was just simply, does this work? Is this making me money? Is this safe? But this, of course, meant that they were particularly flexible and adaptable. And particularly when they went out a second time, particularly into Europe, in this new merchant adventurer guise, they were doing so on the basis of a Russia that was still highly corrupt, a Russia that was at the crossroads of many different commercial sort of connections, ranging from the legitimate ones from, say, the Chinese economy into Europe, through to the illegitimate ones like the heroin trade out of Afghanistan. I mean, at peak, a third of all Afghan heroin coming into Europe came by the so-called northern route, dominated by Russia. So in that context, they could basically go to local gangs, not to try and take them over, but to offer them services. What do you need? Do you need drugs? We've got all kinds of drugs. We've got heroin from Afghanistan. We've got methamphetamine that we brew ourselves. We've got cocaine that we're now swapping with heroin with the Latin American gangs. So basically, any kind of drug you want, we can find it. Do you want guns? Do you need cyber criminal expertise? Do you need your money laundered? Do you want counterfeit cigarettes or anything else? It didn't matter what the commodity or the service was. Odds were the Russians would be able to provide it. And this is really the essence of how they fit within, I say it is primarily European, but it does extend to a degree into North America and beyond. But particularly the European criminal infrastructure, is they're not there on the streets. They are the one-stop shop, though. They are the cash and carry. So some, let's say we're talking about Germany. So maybe there's a German or a Turk or someone else actually on the street corner selling heroin who will work for a local gang, who probably is connected to a larger sort of national network. But if you track back, where might that heroin have come from? It may well have come through Russia, handled by the Russian gangs. And how is that money from the heroin traffic being laundered and moved around? Quite possibly through the Russians again. So there are kind of a higher order, I wouldn't say invisible, but much less visible criminal phenomenon. But most crucially of all, it means that they have built connections with all kinds of local gangs. This is what I think is making them potentially very dangerous. The age of the monoethnic criminal network has not entirely disappeared, but it's certainly under pressure, and especially in a melting pot like Europe. But in terms of criminality, it means that the Russians and all the other Russian-based criminals are dealing with local gangsters, migrant diaspora and indigenous, all around Europe and, frankly, the rest of the world, which means they have contacts and connections. So in some ways, there can be things which have been carried out by non-Russians, which were seen to have no Moscow connection. And yet, if you track back, could be a favour or a service or whatever for one of these Russian providers. So we have these avtoriteti and their networks who are, you know, spread, obviously, throughout Russia, but also throughout the rest of the world. So why should this matter? Why should we be concerned about this, its use as an instrument? Well, that really depends on understanding the relationship between the Russian state and Russian organised crime, which for a long time has been, you know, closer than we might expect or might have liked. Remember, after all, that Stalin's gulags could only really be kept manageable and economically manageable thanks to the co-optation of the real criminals, or at least a certain fraction of them who are willing to work with the state, who in turn policed and controlled the political prisoners who made up the majority of the convicts inside the gulag labour system. And if you read the sort of various and almost invariably horrifying gulag memoirs, you will come across these references to the vori, the criminals, the blatnia, called in various ways, who at the very least shirked their work and allowed the political prisoners to do it all, and the most extreme cases were directly working for the camp authorities. Later on, we had cases of the KGB, who, for example, would often use black marketeers and particularly currency speculators and exchangers to try and keep tabs on tourists who came to the Soviet Union. So, you know, this person who is a criminal on the one hand and is offering to sell you rubles not for the ludicrous official rate of $1 to $1, but for something like a real street rate, could well actually at the same time be working for the state and passing snippets of information back. So, you know, there was a sort of almost an ingrained assumption within certainly the security apparatus, and remember the Russian security apparatus really is the direct descendant of the KGB, that criminals could be used as instruments. But of course, things have changed and things have become much more direct. If one looks at what happened when Putin came to power, 1999-2000, you know, he talked very tough about the need for law and order and to fight crime and such like. And a lot of people took him at face value, including criminals. I remember once talking to one particular gangster who at that time kept a packed suitcase, I mean, I say packed, I think half of it was basically cash in various denominations, under his bed. Precisely just in case, at one point, one of his informants within the local police or judiciary would tip him off that he was going to be arrested, then he could grab the suitcase and make for the airport and try and get out. Of course, he never ended up having to use that suitcase, because for all Putin talked the talk, he certainly did not do anything like swagger the walk of fighting organised crime in any meaningful way. The police and the prosecuting authorities continue to try and do that, but from Putin's point of view, this was never a priority. This was never something that really the state had to put effort into, so long as they understood the new rules of the game. Because what quickly became clear was that Putin was basically offering a social contract to the gangsters, which was this: so long as you don't look like a challenge to the state, so long as you don't embarrass the state, then the state will not consider you to be a priority. So again, the game will continue. The cops will try and catch you, you'll bribe the judges, whatever, that's fine. But the additional level of pain and scrutiny that the state can bring down to bear on you is only when you actually make it worth our while. In other words, when you break these rules. And on the whole, organised crime was willing to accept it. The 1990s, after all, had been a period of anarchy and violence, to a large extent precisely because this new inchoate world, underworld and upper world alike, was still being defined. And so a lot of the violence was precisely because new gangs were trying to establish their pecking order, their turf boundaries and so forth. Already by the time Putin came to power, actually the violence was in decline, because essentially this new order had been already sort of shaped. But what happened was there was a dramatic decline in the kind of open street violence that was such a feature of the 1990s, the car bombings, the drive-by shootings, precisely because if that had continued, that would have looked like a challenge to the state. It would have made it look as if the state was not in charge of the streets and thus was not acceptable. Killings continued. Killings continued actually at almost an unabated rate. But the point is, whereas once it would have been, let's say, as I said, with a car bomb, which would have scared a whole street full of people, quite possibly killed a bunch of innocents, now it was just, you know, in some dark alley, Kalashnikov being emptied through the window of someone's Mercedes, the target and the target's driver bodyguard is dead, and no one else really cares, because you are not really at risk unless you're already in that world. So this is an example of the way that actually what Putin did was essentially house train organised crime. And from time to time, when individual gangsters became a bit too cocky, or because the state felt it needed to make a lesson, there will be some kind of high-profile operation. In 2007, for example, Vladimir Barsukov, also known as Kumarin, who was essentially the leading light within the Tambovskaya gang, which is the main gang in St. Petersburg, and a gang, incidentally, with whom Putin had, let's say, contacts back when he was deputy mayor and generally sort of Mayor Sobchak's overall fixer. You know, it was clear that there were interactions, shall we say, between City Hall and Tambovskaya. But the point is, now that was a pass that Putin himself didn't want to continue to be in the public gaze. And Kumarin was maintaining a sort of profile that was just a bit too public. I mean, at his height, he was known as the night governor of St. Petersburg. The idea was that during the day, the official authorities are in charge, but by night, then it's Kumarin's. This could not be allowed to continue. So in 2007, several hundred police special forces, most of whom had been brought in from Moscow precisely because of fears that the St. Petersburg force was too heavily compromised, anyway, launched a massive armed raid on Kumarin's home with armoured personnel vehicles, helicopters hovering above, and, not incidentally, lots of cameras there to capture the operation. And Kumarin was arrested, charged, and indeed sent to prison. But again, the point was not that they actually needed to have a couple of hundred heavily armed special forces, but they wanted to make the point. It doesn't matter how many men with guns you've got. We've got more men. We've got bigger guns. We are the biggest gang in town. So, you know, periodically, you have these high-profile raids where the state feels it's necessary. But like I say, at first, this was something that was largely applicable on the domestic scene rather than internationally. And more to the point, it was more proscriptive than prescriptive. In other words, the state was saying things that you shouldn't do rather than things that you should. And there were particular exceptions. I mean, when one looks at the massive cyber attack on Estonia in 2007, for example, it's clear that a lot of the so-called patriotic hackers who were involved were what we might think of as criminal hackers, but who were encouraged, basically saying, this is something that you're expected to do. It's up to you, and some did it out of genuine sense of patriotism, some because it was fun, but also some did it because they were worried that if they didn't, then the state might crack down on them. Likewise, if one looks at 2011, there was a case of Chechens being killed in Istanbul, and this was being carried out by Russian gangsters who were actually largely involved in car theft rings in Moscow. No particular beef with Chechens, but again, it seems to have been the case that they were used as convenient, deniable assets. They went in, carried out the hit, and left. 2010, one can also remember the case of Christopher Metsos, who was one of, and arguably probably the only actually potentially productive member of the so-called illegals network of deep cover Russian spies in the United States, who were sort of rounded up at that point. Metsos managed to get away. He got to Cyprus and then disappeared from view. Now, this is not confirmed, but as it's been told to me, the SVR, the Foreign Intelligence Service, that had lots of assets in Greece that they could use to exfiltrate him, but they didn't have enough people or the right people in Cyprus. So they thought, well, who is good at getting people across borders and across water without official notice? And indeed, they turned to a people trafficking group, which I think was not Russian, but was again connected to these Russian business networks, shall we say.
And they got Metsos into Greece, where the SVR took over the job of bringing him back to the motherland. So there have been individual cases, but it was largely, as I say, about what you have to keep your hands off. We particularly saw this, for example, with the 2014 Sochi Winter Olympics and then the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia. In both cases, the Kremlin was very keen that these went off smoothly, that they were excellent soft power operations, shall we say, to give people a particularly different view of Russia. And that included them not being ripped off, not being predated upon. And so what happened? Again, both times, the word went out that we would be most displeased if you targeted these people. There was a particular case during the 2018 FIFA World Cup that, you know, obviously a lot of the tourists were going to come in to or through Moscow. And there was one particular gang that was notorious for frauds, but largely pickpocketing of tourists. And the head of that gang was brought in for a prophylactic chat by the authorities and told, this is a good month for you and your gang to go on holiday. They took the lesson. They went on holiday. However, over time, particularly as the Russian state's sense of being at war, albeit political war, with the West has sharpened, and as this has become a mobilization state in which essentially any individual, any company, any institution, or indeed any gang, can at any point be tapped on the metaphorical shoulder and say, and here there's the words that sort of the motherland needs you to do something and expected to do that, then we have increasingly seen organised crime being brought into the frame, along with many, many other particular institutions. So let's have a break, and then let me talk much more specifically about the use of organised crime as a tool of foreign tradecraft.
Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode.
Gangsters are very rarely going to be the Kremlin's first choice of tool. Because they don't trust gangsters, rightly. I mean, most gangsters, frankly, are incompetents. They're not very smart. They're not very good. We have a tendency to focus on the successful ones and assume that gives us some sense of the overall. Let's notice that, on the whole, gangsters do ultimately get arrested. So let's bear that in mind. They also, the Kremlin is also suspicious of the gangsters' motives. They know full well that the gangsters will do this because of pressure or because of the opportunity for gain, rather than patriotism. On the whole, the state would rather use its own assets, its spies and so forth. But of course, what we've seen is, you know, with this sharpening of international tensions, and obviously even before, but especially since 2022, we have seen the Russian state move its intelligence apparatus into absolute overdrive. And it is now, frankly, as active, as aggressive as the Soviet intelligence apparatus was during the height of the Cold War. And let's note that the Soviet Union was rather bigger than modern Russia. So there's a hell of a lot of demands upon these networks. And as I said, these networks have also begun to suffer some serious hits from expulsions and the like. So what we tend to find is criminals being used to fill gaps, fill capacity gaps, where they particularly sort of have some kind of local advantage or some kind of skill that is going to be of value to the motherland. Now, this can be in terms of hacking, as I've already mentioned. Although what we've also seen is quite a few cases, particularly the FSB, the Federal Security Service, recruiting hackers into its own cyber intelligence arms. Not always with great success, because yes, they have certain skills and you don't have to train them up and everything else. But on the other hand, they also can prove to be still more interested in making money and such like. And there's some serious blowbacks as a result of that. But there's also more general intelligence gathering. And for me, the best example remains in 2014. We had the case of the Estonian security police officer, in other words, his capo officer, Eston Kohver, who was meeting an informant close to the Russian border. Now, this was not meant to be a big deal. It's not like he was investigating some high-profile security issue, so much as actually some fairly low-level smugglers. But nonetheless, there he was. Suddenly, a Russian snatch squad comes across the border, uses smoke grenades to basically separate him from his backup, takes him, drags him over the border, where he's accused of having sort of basically been a spy and intruding onto Russian territory. Even the Russian border guards were not actually brought in on this particular plan, because at first they signed a protocol with their Estonian counterparts confirming that the attack took place on the Estonian side of the border. Why on earth would the Kremlin have done something so brazen? Just for the hell of it? No. It turned out eventually that the low-level smugglers whom Kokhvera was tracking actually were also being used as low-level intelligence gathering sources by the Russians. They were essentially being given a free pass through the Russian side of the border. A lot of them were involved in things like smuggling of counterfeit and untaxed cigarettes, which is actually quite a lucrative business in highly taxed Western societies. And in return for that, they were carrying out some intelligence gathering. Now, as I said, it was not a big deal. But on the other hand, you know, the little granular pieces of intelligence that can be gathered, you know, which particular local border guard officer or police officer is known to drink or to gamble, you know, things like that actually can be useful later on for the intelligence services to target their own particular professional assets against that kind of thing. So, you know, this was an example of the use of gangsters, and I would stress, not Russian gangsters, but as intelligence tools. Then, what about the use of violence? I mean, I've mentioned, for example, the cases in Istanbul and then, you know, the very recent case in Spain. But again, if we want a particular example, the case of Vadim Krasikov, a Russian contract killer who was then basically brought into the FSB as a hitman. And in 2019, he duly went and killed the Georgian Chechen Zelimkhan Khangoshvili in the middle of Berlin. Now, he had the bad luck of being arrested and is now sitting in prison. But unfortunately, his bad luck is bad luck for a lot of other people, like the American journalist Evan Gershkovich, who is currently sort of sitting in prison, almost certainly simply because the Kremlin wanted to have some bargaining chips to try and get Krasikov out. So unfortunately, we now have basically kidnapping, also employed as a tool of statecraft, driven by the Kremlin's desire to visit its vengeance upon people who challenge it. Then there's also Chornaya Kassa. Well, this means black account or black cash box. And it generally refers to the ways of collecting assets which have no obvious connection to the principal. And in this case, the Russian state needs operational funds in order to carry out a lot of its covert operations in the West. Things like, you know, supporting a particular political movement or politician, backing a particular, you know, online news agency or news source that spreads a particularly convenient line. All of these kind of things take money. And the trouble is, how do you get that money? And particularly, how do you have that money in a way that if it's ever tracked by the authorities, it does not immediately can be sort of proven to be Russian state funds? Well, one of the answers is, in effect, you tax the activities of Russian-based organized crime abroad. You approach them and say, look, we know who you are, we know what you're doing, we don't have a problem with that, you carry on. However, we would like you to demonstrate your patriotism by putting this amount of money or this portion of your profits or whatever into these particular bank accounts, which are then under the control of the FSB and SVR in particular, and then can be used for operational purposes. So, you know, sometimes it's just providing money, the fuel of so many of these sort of subversion and disinformation operations that have been carried out abroad. And in some ways, as the logical corollary and extension of that, we have seen, until recently, the pseudo-states of the Lugansk and Donetsk People's Republics, the LNR and the DNR, when they were still sort of technically being presented as nothing to do with the Russian state. Obviously, they've now been annexed. But how to keep them economically afloat when they were these, you know, pretty much unviable bandit kingdoms? Well, the answer is precisely you lean on the bandit side of things. That in fact, organised crime on a massive scale was being used by the Russian state to fund these entities. Whether it's in terms of turning a blind eye to activities of, you know, fraud and counterfeiting and the like, which happened on a massive scale. I mean, the number of, for example, counterfeit cigarettes that were produced in the LDNR territories was quite extraordinary. All the way through to, you know, the smuggling of coal. Coal that was mined in these territories, moved into Russia, for want of a better word, laundered by being mixed with coal that had been mined in Russia, and then sold abroad, largely via Belarus, and in many cases being sold into Ukraine. So actually this was a way in which they could get the Ukrainians to, in effect, pay for these rebellious pseudo-states. Now, as I say, that itself is gone. There's a report that I co-wrote with the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. I'll leave a link in the program notes, which very much sort of digs into this in detail, called Rebellion as Racket. But of course, LDNR don't exist as independent states anymore. But the point is, that is a model that we may well see revived in other circumstances if the Russians have the need to basically generate revenues for regions which otherwise they can't support. And indeed, one of the big issues in the future is whether this is actually a model for Russia, but I'll talk about that in the future. The more that Russia finds itself at political war, and that includes, as a subset, economic war with the West, the less it feels any need to cooperate in law enforcement. I mean, that's law enforcement cooperation, which for a while had survived surprisingly, even, you know, if it was confined to such areas as, say, paedophilia, child sex trafficking rings and the like. But now it is basically dead. But more than that, there is no real downside from the Russians' point of view. They very much feel that, look, they are pariahs already. So why should they not break the rules? So what we are seeing is increasing use of, for example, organized crime, especially in sanctions busting. You know, every time we create sanctions, we create new economic opportunities for criminal actors. Most of the sanctions busting is not being done by gangsters, we should note. It's actually, you know, large exports of microchips and components and whatever else that is being done by, shall we say, shadowy trade facilitators and being sort of exported to one country and then re-exported into Russia. It happens. It costs the Russian state and particularly the defense industrial complex more money than it would otherwise, but it means that it can continue to access this. And frankly, in an age of global economics, it's very, very hard to actually clamp down on this. But nonetheless, gangsters are also involved in this activity, and often on a funny little kind of bespoke level. We've got the case, for example, in the UK of a massive expansion in agricultural crime, including of, for example, the specialist GPS systems that are used to ensure that, you know, when you're ploughing fields, you're ploughing all the land you should, or indeed even things like combine harvesters. And the assumption of the police is that these are heading towards Russia. Now, can you smuggle a combine harvester? Rather difficult. But the point is that what the real need in Russia is these days is spare parts, precisely because of sanctions. So actually, that combine harvester that you've stolen may well be more valuable when broken up as a supply of spare parts than as one combine harvester. And of course, once you've broken it into parts, it's a lot easier to smuggle. So, again, this is not a sort of huge thing. It's not actually as if thousands upon thousands of combine harvesters are being smuggled. But it demonstrates the degree to which organised crime is finding new niches which the state is happy about, because actually what it allows it is to bypass the sanctions regime. We're seeing this also about, for example, engines from microlights stolen in Europe turning up in drones built in Russia and deployed against Ukraine. And so on, the list goes. Why do this if you're a gangster? Well, you do it for two reasons. One is precisely because you can usually fetch a good price for whatever commodity you're actually being able to bring back, if it's something that the state, particularly the state military industrial complex, needs. But also increasingly clear that just like those small-scale smugglers that Kochver was looking into back in 2014, we now find a situation in which essentially the Kremlin is willing to turn a blind eye to all kinds of cross-border criminal activity. if, as a price, the gangsters are willing to bring something good back. So it doesn't matter, are you a drug dealer trying to move your heroin into Europe, or a people trafficker, or whatever else? Fine. So long as, at the same time, you're bringing what the state needs back. And who's coordinating this seems largely to be the responsibility of the Federal Security Service, the FSB, which has longest connections to organised crime, and I would suggest has least, how can I put it, moral qualms about these kind of alliances. There is very, very much a culture that whatever works, works. Whereas if you're talking to the SVR, they tend to still have a lot more of a suspicion and a kind of arm's length approach to the criminals. They still regard themselves, one could challenge this, but they still see themselves as something of a sort of the new elite, the aristocrats of the Russian security state. FSB, let's just say that although they probably also consider themselves to be aristocrats, they're aristocrats who don't mind getting their hands dirty. So, what can we actually say? Well, look, the thing is that crime tends to respond incredibly quickly to new threats, but above all to new opportunities, because it has to. Because it's not bound by the need to follow the rules, follow the laws, submit environmental impact statements or anything like that. And in fact, it needs to be, because it operates in a very sort of Darwinian environment. If you don't take advantage of a new opportunity, your rivals may well, and if they suddenly start getting richer and more powerful, then they will basically start to encroach on your territory and hire away your gunmen and everything else. So, in other words, we can expect organised crime to react quickly, because every time we try and ban something, and it doesn't matter if we're talking about alcohol in the Prohibition era, or Class A drugs in the West today, or certain kinds of trade with Russia, in effect, we hand new opportunities to the gangsters. Doesn't mean we shouldn't do it, but we have to be aware of how the process works. The Kremlin will use criminals when it seems to make sense. And at the moment, it clearly, its number one enemy is the West. Its number one priority is to reduce the West's internal cohesion and its capacity to confine and constrain Russia. So pretty much anything else goes. There are no particular external constraints. They don't really care about how they're perceived anymore. Unfortunately, you know, when you actually, again for understandable reasons, treat another country as some kind of pariah, then you also lose a certain amount of traction on it. And the thing is that as we see organised crime being used, and everything, anything from, you know, direct attacks on our infrastructure carried out by computer hackers, much of which is mercenary, but some of which also seems to be politically driven precisely to disrupt us, all the way through to sanctions busting, we have to acknowledge, in my opinion, that we have not yet properly bridged the gap between Russian-based organised crime simply as a criminal problem, one more in the numerous organised crime threats that beset the global system, and Russian-based organised crime as a security issue, as something that has a more than coincidental impact upon our policy agenda. So this is why I think it's a serious threat, and I think it's one that we need to be devoting a lot more attention to. I am actually going to be writing another report for the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organised Crime on this year. And some years back, it's slightly dated now, I also produced a report called Crimintern on this for the European Council on Foreign Relations. And again, I will leave a link to that in the programme notes. But let me end just by, in some ways, bringing it to the extreme by thinking, well, what is the biggest nightmare that we face from this? But also, what is the big nightmare for Russia? Well, for us, I think it's the notion of some kind of Russian Bureau 39. Now, Bureau 39, for those of you who know, is North Korea's, in effect, Ministry of Organized Crime. It is involved in everything from systematic insurance frauds, netting, it has to be said, millions upon millions of euros, all the way through to drug production. And the point is, its great strength is precisely that it is part of the state apparatus. You know, they produce, for example, or they certainly produced, the best counterfeit $100 bills. Why were they able to do that? Because they were producing them on the government mint printing presses. Likewise, huge economies of scale when producing methamphetamines when you're doing so in government chemical factories rather than some poorly ventilated camper van somewhere out in the middle of the desert. So one could see a situation in which actually, if the Kremlin finds itself leaning more and more heavily on organised crime, that in effect it decides that what it needs to do is nationalise it and create its own Bureau 39, which obviously won't cover every single bit of organised crime anywhere, but nonetheless will make it a lot more coherent and a lot more efficient in the sense of you're not having to have lots and lots of individual deals being struck. So that would be my nightmare, is actually if the Kremlin decides to really structure this in a much more strategic way. But on the other hand, things can also go very badly for Russia. And there's two particular nightmares I'll draw up. One of them is, in effect, the Donbassization of Russia. As I said, the LDNR regions became virtual bandit pseudo-states. Rule of thuggery, where the political elites were not just corrupt, what's new about that, but violently corrupt, and also in a way that they're sort of constantly involved in settling of scores and the like. We could find Russia slipping back towards something like the 1990s, wild ages. That will take time, and that will take some serious economic hammer blows, because remember, one of the reasons why the 1990s could be so chaotic was because it followed this steady degradation of state capacity through the 1980s. Whereas at the moment, there is still actually pretty significant and powerful law enforcement apparatus within Russia. You know, the FSB may be dirty as they come, but there's a lot of people within the police and even the Prosecutor General's office who actually want to do their jobs. So, we are some way away from that. But nonetheless, as we see the tide of general violence, the proliferation of guns and so forth into Russia, beginning to change the nature of the crime scene and so forth, it's not entirely implausible. Of course, the other nightmare, which is particularly one that is held by the Kremlin, and in some ways it's a good thing because it encourages it still to regard organised crime with some caution, is just as the Russians are using gangsters as weapons against their enemy, what happens if the Ukrainians start doing the same thing within Russia? We have seen in particular HUR, Ukrainian military intelligence, using tactics which are imaginative, ruthless, and frankly, borderline deeply immoral. I mean, there's been cases, for example, of Russian pensioners having their money stolen by hackers and then being blackmailed into firebombing conscription offices simply with the promise of getting their money back. Now, again, I'm not actually saying that this somehow means the Ukrainians are terrible. They're fighting an existential struggle. But nonetheless, the same kind of people who came up with that kind of tactic could also, I would imagine, quite easily see the virtues of trying to activate organised crime groups within Russia, who may well have no idea that they're working to Kyiv's agenda, but again, using them whether it's to carry out killings or bombing attacks or otherwise create disruption. And so I think, that's something that in some ways must be a nightmare for the Kremlin and for the FSB. And in that case, well, honestly, it's hard to feel too much sympathy for them. Just as in Alexander Nevsky's, apocryphal, famous phrase about those who come with us with the sword will die by the sword, well, so too, those who come across the rest of the world with gangsters may well find themselves dying by gangsterism too. On that, not quite sure if it counts as an optimistic note, I will stop. Thanks very much for listening. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.